wondering if people who end up in Fairbanks think that since Fairbanks is a remote place, that there's no infection up there.
An outbreak of HIV cases in Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage doctor studies the effects of space travel on your eyes.
Even during 20 seconds or 30 seconds of microgravity, there's a shift in fluid from your legs up into your face and your head and your eyes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The state is concerned about a big increase in the number of new HIV cases in Fairbanks. Last year, Fairbanks reported 8 new HIV cases, and the outbreak is ongoing. In recent years, 2 or 3 new cases was more typical. The state is also seeing a syphilis outbreak in Anchorage. Susan Jones is Alaska's HIV and STD program manager. She says the state first became concerned about the increase in HIV cases in Fairbanks last summer.
The majority of people are men who are having sex with men, and there's a significant number of them that are looking for sex partners on the internet, and they're also then participating in what we're calling anonymous sex, which is people who have sexual encounters with other people that they don't know and they don't really intend to see again. That combined with a younger age group and with people who are either in the U.S. Army or somehow epi-linked or associated with the Army all have us concerned. And our job is to prevent infection. So having this announcement of the outbreak is one way to prevent new infection.
Why do you think these young men are not practicing safe sex? What have you heard from them?
Well, I think that it's probably the same as a syphilis outbreak that's also going on, although that is happening here in Anchorage. I think that there is some letting down of their guard on being concerned about HIV as an infection. And also, I'm wondering if people who end up in Fairbanks think that since Fairbanks to them is a remote place, that there's no infection up there, and that it's safe to do these really high-risk behaviors.
And when you say letting down their guard, I would think the specter of HIV is pretty scary. And what's going on there?
Well, I think that if you are in this time where individuals with HIV look healthy and are taking medication, and it's different than in the early 90s when people with HIV were extremely sick and in the hospital and dying, that's two different scenarios of individuals with HIV. And I think that people today don't remember the early days and don't remember how devastating the illness was, that they think that taking medication isn't that big of a deal. But I think that they also think that they're not at risk of acquiring the infection.
Do you worry there are a lot more new cases that have gone undetected?
Well, we're only talking about a total of about 10 cases since January of last year. So we are concerned that there are new cases that that are not detected out there, partly because when someone is newly infected with HIV, it takes your body a bit of time to mount a response to HIV. It doesn't get rid of the virus, but it reduces the amount of virus in your body. But before it does that, you're really infectious, and you may not be feeling too sick. So you might have a better chance of infecting someone else because you have so much virus in you.
And Susan, you're also reporting a syphilis outbreak in Anchorage. Describe the situation in the city.
this outbreak actually has 19 cases of syphilis that were reported since January of last year. Of those, we know that at least 13 have been classified as what we would call early syphilis. That means that they've acquired the infection within a year of the report date. And those are the cases that we're concerned about. Early syphilis, a couple of the stages in early syphilis are quite infectious. The majority of the individuals that are involved in the syphilis outbreak are also men who are seeking sex with other men. And it also includes men who are seeking sex partners on the internet and also having anonymous sex. So the high-risk behaviors are real similar.
Susan Jones is Alaska's HIV and STD program manager. The Fairbanks Health Center is offering free HIV testing through Thursday afternoon. It's a rapid test that gives a preliminary result in 20 minutes. A House committee this morning approved a bill setting up a loan program for people who want to convert their home heating equipment from oil, coal, or wood heaters to another fuel source. The bill allows the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to provide 1% 10-year loans to homeowners who currently have outdated burners. Sponsor Tammy Wilson, a Republican from North Pole, says the purpose of the plan is to get the public to stop using home heating oil.
Oil is one of the dirtiest ways to be able to utilize to heat our homes. We know that the cost of oil just keeps going up. We're wanting people to look at these alternatives and now realize that in our state that these are options that we have that won't just help our air quality, but will be able to sustain it longer period at a lower cost, more affordable for them.
North Pole voters last fall rejected an initiative that would have banned most wood-burning appliances. City officials were quoted at the time saying that it was the initiative, not the desire for cleaner air, that led to the rejection. The bill originally only allowed conversion to natural gas, but Wilson says since the plan is statewide, it now allows the use of natural or propane gas, electric heaters, and even back to wood in the form of biomass devices certified by the Environmental Protection Agency. Those decisions will be up to the homeowner, but with guidelines from a certified energy rater.
There's no way in a bill that you would be able to designate and tell people which way they had to go. That's why there's a rater that's involved in this. So the rater would come in, look at what you had, and our hopes are that would be a professional that would be able to say, this would work for your house or this would, or this wouldn't, and help you make those decisions on a one-on-one basis.
The bill next goes to the Finance Committee. An identical bill introduced by Fairbanks Democrat Joe Thomas is already in the Senate Finance Committee. House Majority Leader Alan Osterman says he's open to changes to a bill that would reestablish an Alaska Coastal Management Program. House Bill 325 was introduced Friday with Osterman as primary sponsor. Six other members of the House Majority Caucus, four Democrats and two Republicans, co-sponsored the bill. Minority Leader Juno Democrat Beth Kurtula signed on as a co-sponsor immediately after its introduction on the House floor. The bill was referred to the House Resources and Finance Committees. Osterman says he'll request a hearing as soon as possible.
We will request a hearing on it. We will suggest changes that may or may not need to be made, and we will deal with any changes that people suggest as far as the process is concerned and what the bill should look like.
HB 325 closely mirrors a citizens' initiative on track for a statewide vote later this year. Lawmakers can preempt the measure with substantially similar legislation and would have a lot of leeway in doing so. The initiative proposes a coastal management program that gives local communities quite a bit more input than a bill that failed in the House last year. Osterman says the fact that initiative backers collected the required signatures in less than a month shows their strong support for that version of the program.
If I look at just the initiative process and the amount of people that and time frame that it took to generate those signatures to get it on the ballot, I think it shows a lot of support in reference to recreating the program.
Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello is prime sponsor of the initiative and chairman of the Alaska Sea Party, the group behind the signature gathering effort. Botello has said the Sea Party prefers to have the legislature take action because it would help the program get up and running faster and avoid a costly campaign to convince voters to approve the measure. Before closing last year, the Alaska Coastal Management Program allowed the state and local communities to have greater input into federal permitting decisions along Alaska's coastline. It also helped developers by streamlining the regulatory processes of various state and federal agencies. The legislature failed to reauthorize it after the Parnell administration and some House Republicans fought efforts to expand the role of local communities. Governor Sean Parnell has signed a bill easing the state's requirement for certain political candidates to file disclosure information electronically. The governor signed House Bill 311 on Monday, 5 days after it passed both chambers of the Alaska Legislature. The bill provides an exemption to the electronic reporting rule for candidates who have no broadband internet access or personal computer at their primary residence. It also delays the requirement from taking effect for 1 year until February 2013. And prevents the Alaska Public Offices Commission from changing requirements in the middle of an election cycle. The electronic reporting requirement only applies to candidates for state office and municipal candidates in communities of 15,000 or more. H. Bill 311 modifies regulations the legislature adopted in 2007 in response to a federal corruption probe that ensnared several sitting lawmakers. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the first Iron Dog competitors reach the halfway point in Nome.
It's been really, really bumpy. There's some pretty big drifts. Real bumpy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A rocket was successfully launched from Poker Flat north of Fairbanks over the weekend. Saturday night's flight was part of a multi-university project aimed at understanding the effect of the Northern Lights on global positioning systems and other radio signals. Principal Investigator Steve Powell of Cornell University says satellite data indicated an intense stream of charged particles from the sun heading toward the Earth, and the aurora did not disappoint.
Even before the sun set, amazing as it seemed, we began to see the aurora. This is right, you know, above Fairbanks, and which is really highly unusual.
Powell says the tricky part was deciding when to launch. He says success hinged on going up while the aurora was in the rocket's trajectory above the Yukon Flats.
We know we wanted it to be roughly positioned, the aurora positioned over Fort Yukon, but if we had waited until it got to Fort Yukon, then when the rocket caught up to it, the aurora would have probably shifted past that. So we have to kind of project ahead.
The timing worked out. The 46-foot-high two-stage rocket flew an arcing path through the aurora 200 miles above the Earth's surface during its 10-minute flight. Powell says antennas and sensors deployed took measurements and radioed their signals to receivers on the ground. He says the data quality is excellent and will be analyzed to improve GPS signals.
To apply toward computer modeling of the upper atmosphere and the ionosphere so that we can better understand this interaction between all that energy that comes from the sun, the charged particles, and how, say, signals coming from space satellites that travel through the atmosphere down to the users on the ground, such as GPS users, how they're affected by these interesting events, such as aurora and other times when a lot of energy comes from the sun and interacts with the Earth's magnetic field.
Powell says the models will be used to develop GPS programs that compensate for errant signals or warn users about them. He says it's important as people increasingly rely on GPS and an 11-year solar cycle peaks. The project was the only scheduled launch from Poker Flat this season. Poker Flat is operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks for NASA. On February 20th, 1962, John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth. And 50 years later, astronauts still face the unknowns of space. There is new evidence that prolonged weightlessness or even short periods without the pull of gravity can have lasting physical impacts on the human body. In December of last year, in a paper published by the American Academy of Ophthalmology, an Anchorage doctor looked at how space travel can affect eyes. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Ophthalmologist Thomas Mader works at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. He's been an eye surgeon there for a dozen years. Mader spent 24 years in the military, serving all over the world. His last post was at Fort Richardson in Anchorage, and on discharge in 2000, he decided to stay in the state. But it's his passion that takes him out of this world. Mader is a volunteer researcher for NASA.
It's a very interesting group of people to be around, very spirited, energetic bunch of people who are really into science.
While in the military, he began work with other doctors on how weightlessness affects the human eyeball, first doing studies on impacts of short-term weightlessness in high-performance jets. But why would weightlessness affect the eye?
They have a shift of body fluids. Even during 20 seconds or 30 seconds of microgravity, there's a shift in fluid from your legs up into your face and your head and your eyes. And your venous pressure and your neck and your head tends to go up a little bit. And your intraocular pressure can go up. It can go up by 50% just in a period of 20 or 30 seconds.
If a shift in body fluids can happen in seconds, for an astronaut living on the International Space Station for months, could that fluid shift lead to changes in vision?
And we didn't realize these changes were happening right off, neither did anybody else. When they came back to Houston, they filled out a questionnaire. And we found that over time, that roughly 50% or so of those folks who'd been up there for, more than a few months, complained of decreased vision at near. They couldn't focus. It's kind of like if you didn't have your bifocals on.
Further discussions with returning astronauts indicated that vision changes didn't occur right away, but over the time spent in space.
And it seemed like kind of an odd thing to me. So we started doing some basic studies, looking at the back of the eye before and after missions, taking photographs, that kind of thing. And in the meantime, we started giving astronauts space anticipation glasses. Prior to a launch, you'd give them plus reading glasses, the same kind you'd buy at Cars down the street. And at first, when they got into space, they didn't need them. But later on, after they'd been there for a couple months, about half the people started using them because they couldn't see up close.
Even more puzzling, some astronauts suffered eyesight problems, while others didn't. Doctors eventually realized that the change was not in the eye's lens, but in the eye's shape.
But they had disc edema after they'd been in space for about 6 months or so. And by that, I mean that normally when you look at the back of the eye, if you look at it, it's flat. Where the optic nerves comes in, it's still flat. It's kind of like a disc-shaped area that's flat. But these astronauts, when we looked at them post-mission, instead of the optic nerve being flat, it sort of popped up toward you. It was elevated. And these were strange changes. So at that point, we really became concerned about what was happening.
Mader says there's several theories as to what is going on, but none are certain just yet.
I think ultimately the thing that's responsible is a fluid shift I told you about earlier. It was about maybe a liter and a half fluid shift from the legs and the lower torso up toward the head. And it raises the venous pressure. So it might be this rise in venous pressure can lead to a rise in intracranial pressure. In other words, the fluid that kind of bathes the brain, it can have the pressure in that fluid can go up. Just because of the fact when you have that fluid shift, it raises the venous pressure in the neck and the head. But if the pressure is chronically elevated in the venous system, perhaps the pressure around the brain is chronically elevated too.
But he says that doesn't explain everything. It may be that some astronauts are predisposed to the vision changes. The reality of regular space travel is coming closer. Commercial space ventures are just around the corner, and at least one company, Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, is even eyeing Alaska as a potential launch site. Mader says people have been flying in space for 50 years, and no one has gone blind yet, but loss of partial vision is a possibility. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A bill introduced in the state legislature offers energy relief for Alaskans. The bipartisan-sponsored measure would provide vouchers to all permanent fund dividend-eligible adults for 250 gallons of heating fuel or an equivalent amount of natural gas or 1,500 kilowatt-hours of electricity. The non-transferable vouchers would only be redeemable in-state. The bill's prime sponsor, Senator Joe Thomas of Fairbanks, spoke on the Senate floor Friday about the proposal, saying residents of urban locations like Fairbanks are experiencing energy pain.
These costs are crippling the economy of Alaska's second largest city, stifling development, forcing families to start looking to move south, and when they're moving south, they're not moving to Anchorage, they're moving out of state.
Thomas acknowledged that energy costs are even higher in bush communities, but said Fairbanks is also struggling due to a similar dependence on oil for heating and power. He read from correspondence from constituents, quoting a retired couple about their energy costs.
Over $1,000 a month for electric and fuel. We hit with the higher costs of goods and services because businesses are trying to cover their increased costs as well. Mr. President, I wish I could say that these were not typical letters, but unfortunately I received them almost daily, emails, letters. And in the first 32 days of the session, they've been coming in even more frequently.
Thomas said cold snaps in November and January wiped out entire winter energy budgets of some Fairbanks residents. Thomas pushed for consideration of the energy vouchers, despite programs that subsidize efficiency upgrades, again citing correspondence from a constituent.
I received a letter from a small business owner last month who has taken advantage of the energy efficiency rebate program, the weatherization program, the local wood stove changeout program, and our electric utilities home sense program. After taking advantage of all these worthwhile conservation programs, her bills are still higher this year than last.
Thomas said the situation will get worse as oil prices are on the way up. Thomas and the bill's 8 co-sponsors are still unclear on precisely what the one-year program would cost the state. Thomas's chief of staff, Joe Hardenbrook, says they are awaiting a fiscal note from the administration, but estimates funding the bill would take a small percentage of this year's oil tax-fueled $3.7 billion budget surplus.
What our back-of-the-envelope calculations show is about a $300 million cost of the program.
The voucher bill also calls for the state to come up with a better, more equitable way to subsidize high energy costs in following years.
Ongoing energy relief to Alaskans based on the cost of energy in their communities, as well as the heating degree days in specific communities. So the idea would be that Alaskans who face the highest cost of energy and also who need the most energy based on the heating degree days in their community would receive the greatest amount of assistance from the state.
Hardenbrook says any program would only be a temporary bridge until lower-cost energy is available via projects like a gas pipeline or Susitna Hydroelectric Dam. State House Speaker Mike Chenault of Nikiski expressed reservations about the bill yesterday.
That's a shot, one shot in the arm that may certainly get people through to next year, but you're going to still have that same problem the following year and the following year unless you address the actual cost of energy, and that's bringing some type of a long-term energy source to most of those people.
Chenault said he's torn on the subject and admitted there are no easy immediate solutions given the size of the state. SB 203 gets its first hearing in the Senate Finance Committee on Thursday. A Fairbanks entrepreneur is putting up a third wind generator in Delta Junction, and Golden Valley Electric Association intends to buy the additional electricity. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
It's been almost a year since GVEA turned down Mike Kraft's ambitious proposal to erect 16 more of the towering wind generators at his facility in Delta that would crank out a total of up to 25 megawatts of clean, green electricity. GVEA's board of directors decided against Kraft's proposal in favor of building the utility's own wind farm at Ava Creek near Healy, east of the Parks Highway. Since then, Kraft has continued to operate his Delta wind farm, which pumps up to a megawatt back into the grid, and now he's putting up a second 900-kilowatt generator that will nearly double the wind farm's output to nearly 2 megawatts. That's enough to power more than 500 average U.S. homes for a year. Kraft confirmed Wednesday that he's putting up another of the 250-foot-tall wind generators this summer on his 320-acre site about 3 miles south of Delta. That will be the third wind generator overall, including a smaller 100-kilowatt unit. But he didn't want to talk about it on tape. Brian Newton, GVEA's president and CEO, said Thursday that the utility has filed a tariff revision with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to authorize GVEA to buy more renewable energy.
All we're doing with the commission is just resubmitting it to include his new unit.
The tariff revision would extend the basic arrangement that GVEA has had for more than 2 years now with Kraft's company, Alaska Environmental Power. The utility pays about 12.5 cents per kilowatt hour for that electricity. The commission will accept public comments on the tariff revision until March 9th. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The first team of snow machine racers has reached Nome in the 2,000-mile Iron Dog race. Mark McKenna and Dusty Van Meter arrived Tuesday afternoon. For being the first to reach the race's halfway point, they pocket $10,000. Trail conditions for this year's race are either ideal or a nightmare, depending on who you ask. Here's two-time reigning champion Tyler Huntington.
We've been having a real good trail this year. It's been real decent, actually, better than most years. Real fast. I've seen times where there's absolutely no snow in the burn, seen years where there's no trail at all and 4 feet of snow, but this year we had a nice hard trail and good snow.
Huntington's team has averaged over 80 miles per hour despite an early race shock problem on partner Trey West's machine. Rookie Archie Agnes, however, tells a much different story about the conditions.
It's been really, really bumpy. There's some pretty big drifts. Real bumpy. We left McGrath after only 8 hours so we can get some smooth trail in. And we did bust an A-arm and it slowed us down. We changed it out before we left McGrath.
He and partner Arnold Marks are also clocking in around 80 miles per hour during the early stretch of the race. All teams must reach Nome by 11:59 p.m. Wednesday night to avoid scratching. The race winds up Saturday in Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Jeremy Scott in Galena. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.